Government Committee meeting, and while we're hoping for our last member to come in, tell you how grateful I am to have all of you here to talk about some things that are perhaps most critically important to the state of Oregon, but may not be the glamour things that you thought you were coming to get big headlines about. But I will tell you that that's the nature of this committee, and it is someday we may get big headlines, but for now, let's get the people's business done and work on trying to make Oregon efficient and work well. And to that end, I have asked, invited testimony from Patrick Allen from the Office of Regulatory Streamlining to talk about something that, I mean, just catches you in the throat. It's so wonderful. Regulatory streamlining. What a word. Mr. Allen, please.
Thank you, Chair Berger, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Allen, and I manage the Office of Regulatory Streamlining, which is at the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Shortly here, I should be joined by Tom Gallagher, who will also be participating in the presentation. The office was created in February of 2003 by the governor's executive order on regulatory streamlining. In that order, he basically directed state regulatory agencies to look at their business regulations and figure out ways to make them simpler, faster, cheaper, easier to comply with or understand, while maintaining protections Oregonians expect for consumers, workers, public health, safety, and the environment. In other words, the streamlining effort is not about lowering standards. It's about how do we deliver those standards in a way that has a lighter impact on the state's economy. He charged Corey Streisinger, the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, with responsibility overall for the initiatives, and created the office. It was established within the department to provide ongoing research, identify opportunities for regulatory streamlining. We serve as a clearinghouse for streamlining efforts for all state agencies. We spotlight regulatory streamlining successes, share best practices, broker resources for specific projects, and basically fulfill a general coordinating function. What I'd like to do today is to provide you a general summary of what state government has been doing over the past 2 years to streamline business regulations, to share some of the guidance that we've been providing to agencies that are considering proposing new or expanded regulations. I'd like to give you an overview of the 34-bill regulatory streamlining legislative package that agencies have proposed. Many of those bills will be coming to this committee. And then to answer questions that you might have. Additionally, the 2003 session of the legislature created a number of interim committees to look at various aspects of regulatory streamlining and the state's regulatory climate overall. Tom Gallagher, who's joined me today, is the vice chair of the Advisory Committee on Agency Rule Streamlining, which was one of those that was created by House Bill 3120 in the last session, and he'll give a brief overview of that committee's work and findings and recommendations. What I'd like to begin with then is an overview of the past 2 years' worth of streamlining work. I've provided you a copy of a document that looks like this. It's the office's first report to the governor, which was issued last summer. And it provides, I think, a good basic overview of the work that we've done. I'd like to highlight two or three things that are called out in the report. First are the streamlining projects that agencies are engaged in. Right now, agencies are working on or considering and developing over 250 individual projects that streamline business regulations or regulatory processes in one way or another. They range from quite small to a number of projects that are larger. One of the challenges that we face in the initiative is there aren't a lot of blockbuster, Chair Berger talked about headlines, there aren't a lot of blockbuster headline kinds of things that are real attention grabbing. Lots of small incremental changes, but the nature of the work really seems to be that by virtue of lots and lots of small changes, we actually can make progress on the initiative. I've two pieces of detail about these projects. The second document that you have looks like this. That is a complete compendium of all 250 projects that are there, organized by agency, some basic information about what is the project, who benefits and how, some status information, and we've categorized them into some basic categories that are highlighted at the bottom in terms of eliminating overlap and duplication, use of technology, and those kinds of things. You'll also find in the report the gray sidebars are particularly some highlighted projects that we've identified. Some examples that I'd just give you quickly to look at from the margins. include online change of address at the construction contractor's board so that you no longer need to go in and get a paper form, fill it out, and hand it in. Elimination of securities examinations at branch locations by the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities at BCBS. A head office examination provides the information that's necessary, so there's not a reason to go to the branch level. Self-certification of continuing education by chiropractors. Instead of having to submit, all chiropractors having to submit documentation of all their continuing education, the requirements remain, but the Board of Chiropractic Examiners trusts that chiropractors know what they need to do, that they'll do it, and then they spot check. They do a percentage audit to ensure compliance, and that seems to meet the public protection need, but eliminate a lot of paper and time in the system. This past summer, we highlighted 9 projects that focused just on paperwork reduction, and they were just a sampling of those that did that. These 9 projects alone saved Oregon businesses $250,000 sheets of paper a year, and those are projects that have been implemented and are up and running. Now, that ranges from information that's still required, but now it can be done online. A lot of the information that trucking companies need to do, and from weight mile to registration and everything else, they can now go online and do that, to areas where there's paperwork that just doesn't need to be submitted anymore. Second item I'd like to highlight for you that's in the report is a business climate survey. We've gone through 2 rounds of surveying Oregon businesses to get some idea of where we stand in terms of a regulatory climate and get some ideas of places to go hunting for areas to improve. The first round was a statistically valid random sample of Oregon employers. The results are summarized on page 5 and 6 of the report. If you'd like, I'd be happy to go into detail on that, but the point I want to leave you with is that the bottom line thing that we got out of this is we did these assessments of various factors of the state's regulatory environment. We did a numerical measure on them, asked businesses to rate them, and we came up with a composite score. Our intent is then during the 05-07 biennium to go back and repeat the survey so that we've got a beginning point and an ending point, so we've got some ability to do some performance measurement about how have Oregon businesses' perceptions of the regulatory climate changed over time. Third thing I'd like to mention is the online license directory. You can find this at oregon.gov/LIC. It's a complete directory that's been up for over a year now of every single state license, certification, permission, anything that someone would have to come to the state for to get authorization for. We've got it documented. There are over 1,100 entries. The directory provides comprehensive information on what are the statutes, what are the rules, what are the requirements for application, is there a downloadable application form, it links to that, fees, prerequisites, all those kinds of things. And in most cases where it's available, we provide a direct link to be able to search for licensees. In getting the system up and running, we found lots of people coming to it weren't looking for how to become licensed as a beautician. They wanted to find out was someone particularly licensed to be that, so we managed to link that in. We think the combination of all of that makes this the most comprehensive and functional system of its kind anywhere in the country. Again, those are just sort of three examples of items that you'll find in the report. Through all this work, I think we've learned some useful lessons. One of the initial surprises we found was how difficult it really was to get past the level of regulations or problem to specific areas. What exactly can we go fix? What can we go work on? It might be tempting maybe to kind of look at that and say, well, gee, maybe streamlining isn't that big a deal after all. And clearly, I don't think that would be the right interpretation. Instead, I think we found that the problem can best be characterized as one of cumulative impacts. It's not that there's a particular stick out of the pile, and if you fix this one, everything will be fine. It's one thing on top of another on top of another. I can illustrate that by talking about small retailers, convenience stores. I can't state it definitively, but I'm pretty darn sure that convenience stores may be the most regulated business in the state. According to our survey, if you run a typical convenience store, you have a few gas pumps out front, you sell beer and cigarettes, lottery tickets, you got a deli case, you're regulated, inspected, licensed, or something by 12 different state agencies. Okay, now you think, well, that's nuts. Until you start kind of peeling back the onion and saying, well, you got the Department of Agriculture that's worried about food safety in the deli counter. And that's pretty reasonable. You got OLCC that licenses you to sell the liquor. You've got interactions with revenue and state police on cigarette sales. You've got DEQ worrying about the underground storage tank out front, and you couldn't really look at any one of those and say, well, you know, we really shouldn't care about this anymore. But nevertheless, you've got these dozen agencies laid one on top of another that interact with that business. We're taking a crack at tackling some of that. Right now, OLCC Agriculture and DEQ are working together on a pilot project. They're agencies that actually provide some kind of a license or a renewal of some kind of a certification. We're working on a pilot project where they'll issue a combined license between the three agencies so that at a minimum, instead of once a year having to send a check and send information into three different agencies, you've only got one transaction, and we in government worry about how the information and money needs to get separated. We do expect to be coming to the legislature with a bill to authorize that pilot. There's a myriad of niggling technical issues that, you know, DEQ has their fee is late after 20 days and OLCC is late after 30 days and a bunch of that stuff that is in fact statutory that we may need some technical assistance to authorize the pilot. But it's an example of the kind of thing that we're able to generate out of looking at that cumulative impacts issue. What I'd like to do next is turn to legislative concepts and talk about the process we went through with state agencies during our budget and legislative concept development process. We tried during the interim to provide agencies some direction as to how they should look at proposals to create new or expanded regulation. I've provided you a copy of the document that they were referred to in their budget instructions that looks like this. It's a series of questions and discussion points we asked agencies to consider as they looked at those proposals. I'd summarize what's in that document in the form of five basic questions. Who or what are we trying to protect and how? Is the problem real and current, or is it something we're worried about that if we don't regulate it'll come to pass? Do we have some degree of certainty that regulation is the only effective means of dealing with the problem? Is the regulation that's proposed designed in a way that minimizes economic impact while maximizing the public protection that's been identified? And then finally, is there a way to go back and assess the effectiveness of the regulation against whatever it is we're trying to achieve and make changes or abandon it if it doesn't work? We've provided similar guidance that looks a lot like this for agencies that are drafting administrative rules to implement statutory regulations. This is the guidance that we provided to agencies up front before they came forward to you with proposals. They may be good questions that you may want to consider as you receive proposals for new regulation, often which will be, you know, accompanied by a room full of people saying, yeah, regulate us. And kind of feeling back to the question of who is it we're trying to protect and why could be useful. Finally, I'd like to turn to the regulatory streamlining legislative package. You have a document that looks like this without all the pen and ink chicken scratching on it, titled Regulatory Streamlining Legislative Agenda. It's 34 bills that make up our package. Like the regulatory streamlining project we discussed earlier, these bills range from significant changes to small individual improvements, which taken collectively can make a meaningful difference in the state's regulatory climate. Let me give you a couple of examples of those bills. We talked about the license directory and the information that's there. One of the things we can do is query it and find, you know, what licenses have certain factors. We looked for licenses that had durations of a year to ask the basic question, why does the license have a year? Sometimes it's a really great answer, like amusement park rides, where thank heaven someone actually goes and looks at the ride once a year and makes sure it's not going to, you know, hurt people. On the other hand, there's some like electrical contracting business. It's a one-year license. And you think, well, could that be a two- or three-year license without, you know, really jeopardizing public safety? The answer is yeah, except that the duration is statutory. And the reality is, and we found just bunches and bunches of these. And the reality is, an agency is probably going to be reluctant to come up with a bill just to say, let's extend this license from 1 year to 3 years. So we have a bill, House Bill 2094, which I think has been assigned to this committee, that basically blanketly authorizes regulatory agencies, if it's consistent with the public protection they're trying to provide, to offer extended license terms. And so we try to solve all those situations at one time. Another example is House Bill 2095, also assigned here, dealing with professional licenses and other kinds of regulatory reports. We've got a handful of them that require that they be submitted as sworn statements. And in some states, that means that the bottom you say under penalty of perjury, I swear this application is true. In Oregon, it means you actually have to go to a notary and have the document notarized. The outfall of that is if any of these agencies were to ever get to the point of considering electronic or online reports or applications, you can't do it because there's no online notarization function. We, again, ask the question, well, why do these have to be sworn statements? And come to find out that really what we're talking about is getting applicants to take the application seriously. Without there being a sworn statement, a licensing body can still it can still revoke a license for having submitted false information. You can still charge someone with unsworn falsification, which I believe is a misdemeanor. What you lose if you eliminate that sworn statement requirement is the ability to go prosecute someone for the felony of perjury. And you ask the question, well, are we actually doing that? And in the main, the answer is no. So we'll have a bill in dealing with about 8 agencies that have sworn statement requirements asking to remove those requirements as a part of their licensing process. As I said, I provided you with a full list of the bills and would be happy to discuss any of them further. And, of course, we'll be back to talk about some of them in detail as they come up in hearing. The final comment I'd like to make wrapping up is that I mentioned at the outset that the office is housed at the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And I really need to say that the department, in addition, as the state's largest business regulatory agency, has done a great job of working on its own regulations and finding streamlining opportunities, has also provided invaluable support to the statewide initiative overall. The license directory came from the information management shop there. Marketing, all those kinds of things that have really helped us do the work statewide, and I'd like to make sure to acknowledge them for that. What I'd like to do now is turn the presentation over to Tom Gallagher, who is the vice chair of the Advisory Committee on Agency Rules Streamlining, and give you a quick overview of what that committee did, and then we'd follow up with taking any questions you have.
Yes. To the panel, I'm going to ask Mr. Gallagher to speak and then entertain questions on both testimonies. Mr. Gallagher, happy to see you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Gallagher. I work with Legislative Advocates. I was noticing the gallery that we have here today.
We were too.
And the fact that this is the single issue you have on your agenda. I want to tell you that being on the 3120 committee and the 2011 committee was probably the most profitable experience I've had in 25 years of lobbying. And the fact that this room isn't full of business and consumer lobbyists is a testament to, number one, how difficult this stuff is, and number two, how it sort of shoots over everybody's head. What is your timeline today? I can do this in rapid summary form.
We have time to hear from you.
Okay.
I think we're going to be hearing a lot of these bills, and I think we need to know what we're going to be doing.
I appreciate that, because yesterday Pat made me stop talking because in the other committee, and Representative Escoval sat through that, so why he's not here today. Time. This is Pat's already sending me notes. The concept of regulatory streamlining from a philosophical point of view is, I think, timely. We started to put most of these programs together in the 30s and 40s, the environmental programs in the 60s and 70s. They were built around a philosophy and a system. They were built around a technology. That's all changed. And I think it's time that we found some process way to go back in and take a look at it. I said yesterday, and I've repeated it to all of my environmental friends, nothing involved in this process involved touching one jot, title, or iota of public policy outcome. The business people that were involved had no interest in finding a sneaky way to get around a regulation that they didn't like, or keeping somebody out of the room, or public input that they should have and will have under Oregon practice. So it is purely about process and management, and those are extremely difficult topics to get into inside of our system. Let me just give you a couple examples of what I mean. Over the past few years, starting with Governor Kitzhaber, he put together something that put 5 or 6 and has now grown to, I think, 8 agencies called the Community Solutions Team. Hired a bunch of governor's staff people to get in and try on projects to get agencies to work together. And we've constantly defended that down in Ways and Means as another cost layer on top of something that people are supposedly supposed to be doing anyway. The Community Solutions Team turned into the Economic Revitalization Team. The Economic Revitalization Team and discussions there on the budget, oh, I thought it was a fan, turned into House Bill 3120, and the governor's own views of this led to the opening of the Office of Regulatory Streamlining. I think the Office of Regulatory Streamlining is one of the bright lights right now in beginning to analyze and understand that. And if you listen to what Pat's doing and what he's talking about, it is truly, really nuts and bolts. And somebody coming in asking people who've done it that way for how many years to think, why are they doing it that way? Other than just philosophy, I think there's some very practical aspects to what we're doing here. And I think those practical aspects have to do with money. Regulatory streamlining can produce efficiencies that, if you don't touch the revenue stream, allow those dollars to be used either in positive ways inside of the agency to go back out and do more service to the constituents that they deal with, or in some cases, and I think mostly in regulatory streamlining, we're not talking about big enough dollars to bail out anybody's human services or school fund, but we are talking about saving considerable money for the regulated community. And just a lot of the things that Pat talked about, and I know that some of you have been in small businesses and have been involved in other, even not-for-profit projects like that, where you don't really have the staff like a big company to constantly deal with this, and it's the manager or the person who's running the business who has to sit down and figure out how to respond to that, call the agency, track down where it has to go. For the companies I represent who are big businesses who are involved in lots of permitting and lots of agency stuff, we can be talking in the neighborhood of hundreds of thousands of dollars in terms of hiring consultants, hiring people that know the agencies, are able to track down in multiple agencies where you have something like a water permit, etc., or where you're putting together a restaurant and you have to deal with OLCC. That specialized knowledge of how to get into an agency, that's what government relations consultants sell. And it's a cost. It's not a cost that ends up in the state budget, but it's a cost that ends up out there, both in disaffected parties and in people who are paying a lot of money just to my favorite restaurant remodel down there. And I know what they went through with their remodeling stuff in terms of the additional, not additional, but in terms of what it costs them to actually go through the permit process. So in the past interim, or going back a little bit, there were some of us that started to look at this in 2001. We started looking at Chapter 183, which is administrative rulemaking. We didn't come up with any specific proposals. We followed some stuff in the legislature. In 2003, we came back with a bill, 3120, and another bill, 2011, which was on siting of industrial projects. And then we spent all of the interim in 2004 on these committees and on the subcommittees. And I personally probably have about 10 hours a week in the last year on one or two of these committees. And I have never, after 10 years of dealing with government from the inside, representing public employees, and now 20 years of doing this, I have never had the opportunity to get that deeply into the process. The 3120 committee was an absolutely great group of people. It had agency heads like Corey Streisinger, who chaired it, and Stephanie Halleck, who's done, in our judgment, just a tremendous job in DEQ. It had Maureen Kirk from Osberg. It had Louise Soliday, who was the governor's natural resources advisor. It had Pat Allen on it, valuable. And we spent a lot of time looking at this stuff in quite an academic way. And let me just digress here a second to give you one of the debates. Early on, we came up with the idea that you should be able to waive a rule that produced an absurd outcome. I mean, sometimes you get fact situations that the rule sits down and looks at and goes, well, that just shouldn't apply here, but it does. So we pursued that. And we pursued it with the Department of Justice. We pursued it with agency heads. And let me go through a couple of things that we sort of looked at. Number one, interestingly enough, there are some groups out there that think no rule applications are absurd. So you've got to be careful about the interest groups that you get involved with. Number two, who decides when something is absurd? There were interest groups that were sure that some agency would say, well, you don't need an air pollution permit here. That's really not smoke and steam coming out of your stack there. That's just hazy day. So they were terrified that we would open this idea of waiver and perhaps uncork a bottle here that some awful thing would happen. And I understand that. The Department of Justice spent weeks researching this issue. How would you draft a rule in an agency that allowed waiver? And then how would you defend it from ministerial complaints that, well, you waived their application or that application to them. Mine's pretty close to that. agency administrator said, do you think we're stupid? Why would we go out and open the door to this? And I remember sitting there in one of these meetings going, let me see if I have this kind of put together here quite simply. Based on everything we know, it's better public policy to apply a rule absurdly than to figure out how not to do it. And everybody said yes. Well, when I say it's time to move into the 21st century on some of that stuff, and when I say it's not easy to figuring out some of that stuff, that's kind of what I'm talking about. It is not that Pat is picking the low-hanging fruit. The difficult fruit is in the process. It's in how we put it together. Let me use, for example, if you turn to your paper on the report of the advisory committee and turn to page 4, and I'm not going to go through the report in any detail. You have a bill, House Bill 2188, which we will be in here advocating. I hope it's in this committee. Which is the one legislative result of this committee report. But I'm going to look at those 6 points, or basically 5 of them, on page 4 and talk a little bit about them. Interestingly enough, the business reps, the environmental reps, the agency reps all came very early on to the conclusion that there is no substitute for good management. There is nothing you can do in statute, there's nothing you can do in front of a committee that will take the place of a well-run agency led by a highly trained professional manager. We do have examples of what happens when you don't have a well-run agency, and that takes place legislatively in the Ways and Means process, where people go in and beat the stuffing out of an agency. It happened to ODOT over a period of time. It happened to LCDC over a period of time. It's happened to Fish and Wildlife. And eventually, through that very horrible process, new people are appointed to head agencies. Different things happen, but a correction is made. An external force forces a correction. I think that is, as a legislative process and as a practical management process, I think that's terrible. One of the first things we did on good management was this factors agencies should weigh when evaluating need for expanded regulation. And that was essentially put together out of a series of discussions by Stephanie Halleck and Corey Streisinger. And is now gone in the AG's manual on rulemaking. And what it is sort of, hey, wait a minute, stupid, did you look at this stuff? And you look at it and go, well, how, you know, what is this? Well, we have example after example after example of agencies that failed to do this. Let me give you a specific example. DEQ had a rule. One of their sections was going to write a rule. They have statutory authority that directs them to get rid of asbestos. It's bad stuff. Get it out of there. And so the department sat down and met with the asbestos removal people, and they came up with a magnificent way to get rid of asbestos, and they began to promulgate a rule. Based on this limited information of these enthusiastic staffers and this business of agency removal, they decided to prohibit anybody from putting asbestos in their trash and to forbid any garbage company from picking up the trash that had asbestos in it. Now, if you've ever gotten out early in the morning, along comes this truck, an alarm goes out, and boom, 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 the trash goes, and somehow, magically, the waste company was supposed to know that, I think there was asbestos in there. And then they were supposed to get out, fish it out, go up to the door, knock on it, and say, you have violated Rule 753. So we went screaming in to the director, which is the way you normally do this, and the director sat down and looked at us and said, I know. Why do you always come running in here? Can't you see I'm training these agency staff people on how not to write a stupid rule? Go yell at them. And here we were, you know, sitting there kind of being chastised by the agency director. And we thought, well, okay, we could do that. I mean, that makes sense. And so we did that. And they went back and fixed the rule, and it was fine. But here was an agency manager practicing management in a very effective way. I can't say enough about that one, and I can't say enough about how many times we don't have that. And it creates part of the regulatory backlog that you think about. There's no silver bullet in rulemaking that will magically make every government regulation acceptable to all parties. 9 times out of 10, when you get a complaint about rulemaking, you get somebody who's either just irritated personally, have been through the mail, doesn't want to do that, or you get a complicated layering of regulations. And the one thing I think we can get at is the complicated layering of regulations. Now, we're going to talk about only state agencies because that's basically what's in our purview. And the committee, in about the first week, we said we're not going to talk about local government regulations or the interface because you will have a room full of local government people telling you not to tread on their prerogative. And as long as you guys continue to honor that, you will have difficulty getting any kind of common sense out of a complicated system of state and local government. And I'm not sure, after many conversations, why local governments consider local prerogative right up there with the Magna Carta and the Declaration of Independence, but they do. They will, and I'll complain. But most regulations have a constituency group that supports them and a regulated community that's involved with them that has found a way to make them work. You do not get most complaints about when somebody comes in and says there are 75 shelves of regulations, okay, but only 5 pages on the left end really apply to you. Now, what are you really complaining about? Reducing government regulations is more of a bumper sticker than a practical goal because most people, your communities, and even regulators want clear, basic regulations. They want to know what the rules are. They want to know how to do it. One of the things that Pat is working on, and one of the things that's in 2188, is helping out small business. There's nobody out there able to do that. Even though you have small business representatives here, they're not out there on a daily basis working with government regulations. I mean, J.L. Wilson is one person with the NFIB, one staff person. He couldn't possibly do this. Most really small businesses, unless they're part of the Restaurant Association or something, don't really get involved with government. They're not on advisory committees, etc. They need some help. And putting another staff person in regulatory streamlining dedicated to small business, who's kind of like that old Henry's beer commercial, will go over to the agency and say, where are you going with all that beer? Why haven't you thought about how this impact is going to impact small business? And it's incumbent upon you to find another way to do it. Without being critical of agencies, a great number of regulations are done for the benefit of the agency, and they're done in the way that the agency can best manipulate and utilize that data. And there's nobody in there, if you're not in front of an advisory committee or somewhere else, pounding on them, this is too hard for me. And in the period where we were building regulations and when the consumer groups and the other interest groups were there, most of the time those businesses got rolled over because that was the old way of regulation. I think we could do it better. There is a need to review and eliminate arcane and ineffective regulation. There is no way to do that, but there is a need to do that. There is simply no incentive in an agency to come in and get rid of programs. They will irritate a constituency group. And that constituency group will be in here in front of you screaming. And there's no effective budget or management reason for the agency to do that. Why would I get this group mad at me? And if I come in and pro-offer those cuts, the co-chairs will take my money and give it to schools. So, and I got to go back. The unions don't want to have me to cut out 18 jobs, realistically. I don't think we have to cut jobs. I think there's plenty of things for these agencies to do, and I think there's plenty of good things for them to do, and if we reprioritized what they were doing and put them and focus them on the places we need them right now in the year 2005, they're going to have the same staff and the same number of dollars and resources. We talked about small business, and we talked about how difficult it is to make these changes. I have a couple of documents I'm going to leave with you. One of them, these are the top half of this page are simply reports that are both done on land use and regulatory streamlining, on other permit streamlining, and on the 3120 committee. The 2011 committee, and the second one is a is a practical breakdown I did. This is my, these are both my work, so they're not agency work. Practical breakdown I did for folks about all the different things that are happening, because very few people were sitting in on all the committees and subcommittees. There's a tremendous amount of data that we've collected and gathered. There's a 2011 report that's coming out, which is on permit streamlining, and that was a committee chaired by Ray Knapp of the Governor's Office and Betty Atterbury of the Westside Economic Alliance. It had six agency heads on it and eight members of the development community, and it broke down into four subcommittees, one on permit streamlining, one on water-related issues, on water permitting, one on transportation, and that was cooperative between state and local, and one on land use appeals. There was 25 lawyers in a room, which I think you're probably better off in a room with 25 psychiatrists or social workers than you are with 25 lawyers. Out of the 2011 committee, there is no legislation. There is recommended legislation. Nobody drafted any. And there are complicated reasons for that, one of which a lot of the final results not everybody agreed with. And some of them are being implemented by agencies internally. Some of them the governor's office wants to do. So there was a whole series of things there where out of that committee there was no momentum to go back like there was on 3120 and to draft a particular bill that represented the results. I think you're going to see a lot of the 2011 committee report, and I urge you to read the appendices, because the appendices is where the debates are. That's the raw data collection before it got all refined down. The startling stuff is in the appendices. And let me just give you one quick example of how that worked. In the transportation group, Bruce Warner personally participated in all the work groups, along with the cities and the counties and most of the major transportation firms like Kittleson and so forth, and the development community. How are you going to get those little street cuts and those interconnects between local city roads and the feeders into the state highways? And when somebody comes in with a project that affects four, that ODOT decides affects four ODOT intersections, and it's actually the city of Tualatin's permit, how does ODOT interface? There sits Bruce Warner, and he says, you know what? The city should notify us right away. They should notify the region. And the region should go in right away at the very beginning and outline what they see as their needs or whether or not they think that that project will have any impact. We thought, that's wonderful, Bruce. Okay, how much is that going to cost? How many more staff people are going to need to do that right? And that's always the hook. Why would I need any more staff people? Shouldn't that be more efficient for us? Good agency management looked at the problem differently. And now, I think Bruce is going to do that. I think he can implement that on his own. There's tons of little things in there. There were little ideas in there of people creating one-lot enterprise zones, single-lot LIDs, all sorts of ways to fund that particular intersection, which would take some statutory change. Let me kind of wrap up, and I do hope that there's some questions into what you want to get into a little more. There is floating around, and may very well be, a bill draft on creating a process to get agencies to work together. And not through the creation of an ERD or an overvisory team or supervisory group of people. Where the problem exists 9 times out of 10, and I'm going to leave aside philosophy of the agency and the pushings of the special interest group. Those are just normal things we're always going to have to deal with. And they're validly there, and we should work through them. Most of the time, the problem comes from overlapping statutory direction and authority. And if you think of it, that's not so unreasonable. They all grew up here, there, anywhere. A good example, you're going to hear about it in the legislature, which is the Hammer case, which says the difference between preliminary plats and final plats. And the Court of Appeals looked at this case and said, by golly, when the surveyor okays the final plat, that's a land use decision. And you're going to have to notice it again. Well, why? Because there's an arcane reference in the statute to surveyors. that says actions of surveyors, the surveyor signs off on the final plat, and they then put the final plat into the land use system, so they bootstrap the whole thing for purposes of this case, quite frankly. They bootstrap the whole thing in. Now the counties and everybody's going crazy. We're going to have to pass a statute that lets the surveyor do the surveying work without making it a land use decision, and gets down to the point where there's only one notice on that particular platting or that particular land use action. So it was just a case where the courts looked back at it and they picked up a section of the statute that had been sitting around for 60 years that was written for surveying and the old system of how you map and plat. And now it under the land use laws, it's a land use decision. There it is. How do you go back and get the agencies to coordinate those how do you have to take the statutes away or they can't coordinate? How do you find them? How do you then get the agencies to sit down? I mean, these are each tiny little European nation states, I think more like Italy in the 15th century city states, and they are not going to give up one ounce, inch, bucket of dirt to the other one. And how do you get to play the Medici here and pull all that together? Don't have all the answers to that. And the reason we don't have the answers is this would take either direct gubernatorial, the governor to say, I want to do this, or the legislature to say, I want to do this. Now, I will tell you, there are a number of legislators, especially in Ways and Means, who are picking up on this. Ways and Means is on a dollar hunt. And if it's not nailed down or not painted white, they're going to take it. So somewhere along the line, a substantive committee who can pick this up. I kind of happen to believe, looking at what I see here, there are not a ton of big bills. There's a ton of little bills. There certainly is opportunity because for both Democrats and Republicans here, because everybody wants to move some money into human resources and schools. And there's also a good reason to take each opportunity or sliver of light as it presents itself in this complicated process to try and dig your way into it. I think Pat and I and Corey Streisinger and any member of that committee would be happy to work with you. We're certainly going to support 2188, and I'll end with that.
Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you both. Questions?
Madam Chair?
Mr. Gallagher, can you give us a timeline on the 2011 report? When that
It's out.
It's out now?
Yeah. If the committee staff can get it, I think, from Gabrielle Schiffer over at the governor's office on economic revitalization team, it may have already been distributed at some point because it is a report to the legislature.
Yeah, I'll have it sent to all your offices.
If I could just clarify something Tom said earlier. Actually, the 2011 committee was made up entirely of private sector and local government participants. They met jointly with the directors of the economic revitalization team. Those directors weren't part of it. And the report, as I understand it, went to the directors and the governor, but it's available for distribution is, I think, what the status of that is.
Okay. I need only point out that Pat is totally correct there. And the correction he made and the way he made it is an example of the love-hate relationship between the private sector and the agency heads and how they got to common conclusions and mutual respect. And it included many of these complicated little sidebars about what the technical piece is and so forth. And that was a very important part of it. We each got the benefit of each other's insights as long as nobody left any fingerprints on anybody else. And it was very good. Those of you that are, freshmen or first-year legislators this time, first-time legislators this time, will begin to pick up that dynamic. It's a valuable and powerful one. Those agency heads have to remain independent. They just get pushed from every side, left, right, up, down, and they've got to maintain their independence and their integrity.
Representative Senator, you had a question.
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. Gentlemen, thanks for being here. And I don't understand completely the extent of your mandate from the government, but I didn't read anything here about OLCC. OLCC, a state agency that supplies at least semi-autonomous retail stores and bars and the like. I had the privilege of visiting OLCC headquarters directly after I was elected. Mm-hmm. And I got to tell you, I have never in my life seen such a disarray, a way of not running an agency or business. Any private business in the whole world would be out of business tomorrow if they were operating the way they are. Not because they want to, not because they're inefficient. It's because they're constrained by some regulations that don't permit them to join us here in the 21st century. They actually have a lady who sits and operates a typewriter. Typing, I'm serious. She types out cards of licenses and violations for particular inns and bars and taverns and the like, hand carries it to a Rolodex file. They got a motor on the Rolodex file, so they're semi-updated. And then while the OLCC agent waits on the telephone, she researches the record of the complainant and gets back to him with the information he needs. He can't access it from a laptop in his car. He can't go on to the next inspection until he runs through that archaic process. We're a few dollars away of OLCC profits to upgrade that system, that computer system, to make them efficient. Efficiency in government, is that not what we're talking about? We need to diligently look after things like this that are wasting the people of Oregon's money. Do you not agree?
Madam Chair, Representative Sumner, one of the things that we did was not try to get into what's right or wrong about an agency like that. And we looked at a number of fact situations, case models. We set ourselves up and did some case models like that. And while we didn't do this one, let me tell you what, based on my knowledge and what you just said, some of the things from a management perspective I observe. Again, you're back to a set of statutes in an agency that was put together right after Prohibition that has a dual mission: sell liquor and prohibit people from drinking it. and that's a complicated agency mission. And the commission attended many commission hearings. They grapple with that. They have, again, very powerful interest groups. The beer and wine people and the hard liquor people and the regulation of those is market share. So when you have a regulated community and you have a battle over shelf space, etc., you have a distribution system for which the interest groups plus the general public has a difficulty perceiving where they want to be able to buy liquor. Do they want it off in a separate little liquor store, or do they want to buy it in the Safeway? And somebody comes back from California and says, it's great, I love it, you could just right there, nobody was abusing the system. Somebody else comes back from California and says, I can't believe it, the stuff is all over the place, kids can see it. And the commission has to weigh all of that. And a number of committees have tried to weigh into OLCC particularly, and quite frankly, the interest groups bring that to a screeching halt. And that's part of the process when we start thinking about regulatory streamlining and start thinking about management. That either there is a compromise, that a process that can get to compromise among these interest groups, or somebody has to make a policy decision that one interest group loses and another doesn't. And I don't apply that to OLCC. I apply that to any agency where you have these kinds of issues. So in my view, I step back, we say is, if you can't do all of those reviews in a committee like this. This is really not the venue for that. You get a few people sitting up here and meeting you in your office, giving you the Sodom and Gomorrah line or the business efficiency line or whichever way. I mean, that's difficult to parse through because you don't have a clean, full set of facts. How would you find a way to set up a process to do that? I think that's the challenge for this committee. This committee is not to go out and untie the Gordian knot, but to set up a way to do it.
If I could just add to that, way back at the beginning of the presentation, I talked about the fact that the streamlining initiative wasn't about changing standards. It was about how to more effectively and efficiently implement those standards. Anytime you get into a discussion about OLCC, you discover what I think are two fairly separate issues. One is, should the state be in the business of selling alcohol? And there's a lot of, every session there's lots of back and forth on that issue. The second issue is, given that the OLCC is responsible for administering a lot of regulations about alcohol, how can we do those more effectively? I talked about the combined license for small retailers. First, the issue of should the state sell alcohol or not is a great policy discussion that is not anything that I'm anywhere near in terms of regulatory streamlining. That's at the level of what are the standards, what is it we want to achieve. In the combined license discussion, OLCC has done a great job coming to that table, doing things that for them, because of the things Representative Sumner talks about, are really hard, but really working hard to figure out how they can participate in a system to make that system work better. I think what you end up with those is kind of a I was going to say a hangover, which would be a really bad pun. The first policy discussion sometimes inhibiting their ability to do the second part, because I think there's this unresolved policy issue, not unresolved, but a policy issue around which there's a lot of discussion. It makes it harder for them to then really be able to do the business operation things that you might like to see them be able to do. That notwithstanding, they are working really hard with us on this combined license to find ways to make their regulations easier to comply with.
Okay.
By all means.
I in no way meant to open the discussion about whether or not we should sell alcohol or the way they conform to the regulations. It's simply a matter of the way they're doing their job.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they're doing their job is grossly inefficient. So long as it's lawful for the state to sell alcohol, we should at least have the distribution and the enforcement of the laws at least workable, and not use and not rely on 19th century technology.
Madam Chair, one question I had, excuse me, and I'm sure this is true for all of our districts. You know, small business is really critical, and when I was walking the district, I heard from a lot of small business owners or people who work for smaller businesses just how they're overregulated, and whatever we could do for streamlining. I think everyone's for streamlining. It's sort of course. You mentioned House Bill 2188 and then small business sort of in talking about that. And I'm reading the description, and I wonder if you could just sort of unpack that a little bit vis-a-vis small business, because I don't know that I am fully grasping how.
Well, House Bill 2188, I think what Tom is getting at, I'm trying to get him to...
I see what he's doing now. Thank you. Again, back to this. One of the things that I pushed very hard was an additional staff person in the Office of Regulatory Streamlining. I think it is in the governor's budget.
An additional person is not in the governor's budget.
It is not in the governor's budget. That additional person would be charged with... And the way I describe it goes this way. They would be in charge of working with the agencies to protect in that sense, to represent small businesses in front of the agencies. They would not be like an ombudsperson. They would not be out there for every small agency to go call up and go in and say, I want to bitch about this regulation or anything like that. They would be in the system oversight that would concentrate on the cumulative effects of regulation, the redundancy of regulation from agency to agency, and would constantly go to these agencies and say, as Pat said for the OLCC, why can't we have all of you feed your data collection into one agency? It's collected on one application, and then the agency will disperse it out to you. So one of the pieces we did there for small business, because Pat has been doing part of this. I mean, he combs through. I mean, this is one person trying to do all of this. So that's a practical thing in here. It's a small piece, and I think it's only a makeshift piece. There needs to be clearer statutory direction on telling agencies through statute that they must do this. And there's a draft of a working paper back there and some meetings going on. In fact, there will be one starting at 2 o'clock this afternoon with legislative drafting to see if we can't figure out how to write that omnibus statute. And it will probably entail this time some pilot projects. Agency managers learn pretty fast, and agencies do copy each other, and they do learn the good things, and you don't have to tell everybody to do X, Y, and Z. If we could find some examples that they could follow, if we could create some positive projects that would be examples for agencies, they will do it. Use of advisory committees is another issue for small business, and if they can reach out and find a small business person to sit on their advisory committees, and if they would use more advisory committees, and we try to push them to do that in this bill, they may get some of that impact. They may get somebody sitting there saying, wait a minute, do you know how many times I have to report to the employment division? Why does the employment division come down one day and the IRS come down another day and do the same audit of the same books, which I just put away? It's those kind of things where the agencies go, hey, it's not my fault. I'm directed to collect all this information. And it's not my fault. This is what I got budgeted to do. I mean, this is the way we do it. We do it on a different schedule than they do it. Leave me alone. I can understand that.
Sure. Chair Berger, Representative Blease, if I could just add, without wanting to speak to the issue of the proposal to add staff, I think one of the interesting things we run into is in a lot of these regulatory areas, we're talking about a business with a person or two being regulated by an agency with a staff of a person or two. And a function that we're currently working to try to fulfill in the Office of Regulatory Streamlining is to provide a little bit of added capacity to raise issues or questions. Right now, what I do is I look at each and every proposed administrative rule and identify whether it looks like they have a business impact, and then actually review the economic impact analysis that agencies do. And if it looks like maybe there are questions or issues that weren't considered, I try to raise those with those regulatory agencies. But you're really talking about a conversation. It's great to talk about advisory committees and those kinds of things, and for the larger regulatory agencies, working that system better is a big object of what we're doing. But for a lot of these agencies, helping them see some additional perspectives, improve training, which we've been working on over the past couple of years, and then some capacity in the office to look at things and raise questions is really, I think, what Tom's getting at.
Thank you. Further questions? I have one, Pat, particularly. Have other states gone through this process? Do we have? I know I always ask this question because I hate reinventing the wheel.
Mm-hmm.
And where are we sort of in relation to how other states are looking at this?
Chair Berger, when I first started the job just a little less than 2 years ago, that was one of the first things I sat down to do was to really look at what other states are doing. And I found lots of examples. New York is probably the best example of approaches that I think had a real different flavor than what we've done. I think the governor's comment statement on the front page of the New York website is, are you tired of government being on your back? Call this office and, we'll fix your regulatory problem. That's a way to go, but it's real typical. There are a handful of other states that I think have really kind of taken an approach that has more of that flavor. We, I think, have done something that's fairly unusual in trying to say we're just not going to have the standards discussion. We're not going to talk about let's lower protections for whatever. Let's really focus on effective regulation. How do we deliver those standards in a way that effectively protects what we're trying to protect? But part of that effectiveness is doing it in a way that has as minimal an impact on the economy as possible. And so, it may be at some point it's appropriate to get to that discussion of, is this standard appropriate? But there's a lot of ground that we can cover before that. And I think it so far seems like a reasonably unique approach compared to other states. There are a number of city efforts that have really looked at, come more from this perspective, as well as some international efforts. Australia and New Zealand particularly come to mind as efforts that look a little bit more like what we're doing.
If I may add a little bit to that, Madam Chair, we actually, through Pat and through a subcommittee, did a number of stuff. We went up and looked at a city in Washington, I think, Tacoma. We pulled in some people from agencies that are, from associations that are regulated in multiple states. And in my view, this is my one person view, what we judged out of that, and John Chandler and I started with the New York system. They have an Office of Regulatory Efficiency that's staffed with hundreds of people. and John and I called our counterparts in New York State to ask them how it worked. And they went, well, you know, so it works, it does work, it's just another agency. I mean, they didn't complain, they didn't gripe, but and they said it did have some impact in slowing regulation. Whatever that means. I mean, I don't know. Sometimes we need regulation, you know. Just slow it. I mean, as a measurement tool, just slowing it is not measuring anything very effectively. We didn't find much of anything like what we're talking about. We went on an extended lit search. Me, Googleized this to the nth degree and found hundreds of review articles on this. Almost all of them are on the federal appellate appeals process. And so just doing this, you know, dishwasher work of going back and cleaning up your statutes and looking at a process and developing a way like an office, a small office of regulatory streamlining, nobody's done that. That's just plain hard housekeeping. Not glamorous.
Representative Galizio, you have one.
Googleized, I think that's a great term. I think I understand. I had one question to Tom, something you said early on in your remarks that really caught me. I just have a different understanding of what constitutes public policy. You said this is about process and management and no public policy outcome. And I just don't see how you separate those out. I think they impact one another. So could you just explain what you meant by that?
That's a very fair question. I think pursuing that is, if anybody goes ahead with this, is going to be an issue. If you take a statute out and move it, or give the authority by statute for an agency to delegate it, some people will perceive that statute might not be as rigorously enforced by the second agency. So they would say that's a policy outcome. And you will hear lots of arguments about that. I've resolved that debate in my mind of saying and assuring my friends in the environment that come on in. And they were very skeptical of what we were doing and watching it from the outside. They didn't attend too many committee hearings. They said, what are you trying to do? And I said, what do you think we're trying to do? Oh, awful things. And that's just the nature of the way the dynamic works. So in my view is, and let me use an example that I've been working on. If you took an agency like DSL, and there are 9 agencies that affect water quality in some way, shape, or form, took an agency like DSL and statutorily designated them as the primary agency, and said, we've learned a lot in the ERT process, so out there in Region 4, we want the DSL, the application, the permit application to go to DSL. We want the rules of Fish and Wildlife to say you should immediately engage with DSL and look at the affected species. You should match your timelines together so that the processes are working in tandem. They should refer to your expertise in this area. And you have an open process by which you kind of merge that application with all of those agencies to become more efficient so that all sides are confident that this merging or this changing of timelines still gave them adequate time to get their responses in to study the problem. There was plenty of public notice of each and every one of the applicants. Right now, even when I ask the environmentalists, they kind of have to be experts in the agencies to track this stuff down. Now, let me get into my bias and one of the clearly where I'm going on this. To me, there are two parts of this process. There's the public process with an agency rulemaking, which you go through and you try to resolve the conflicts and you come up with a policy decision based on the statutory authority that you're given. And then there's what I call the NIMBY. And the NIMBY goes at the process from the point of view of saying, I don't want it to happen. Now let me comb through every statute, every direction, and let me find a way of saying no. Now, in our system of government, and this is totally personal with me, in our system of government, the concept of compromise and the concept of the rule by law and the rule of that way can be changed. And it's changed in statute, and it's often changed in rules. But the debate shouldn't be focused on that permit, on that final end. And Chandler has a nice way of saying it. He says, if you took the pyramid, which goes like this, here's the application or the rule here in the legislature. 20 people come in and testify. Then there's 40 people involved in the rule. And as soon as they go out to cut the orchard on the land up here just in West Salem, which has been an orchard for 40 years, but which now has been zoned for 10 years as multifamily housing, and they want to do the multifamily housing there, then there are 400 people involved. So the public permit process goes like this. John says, turn it over. Allow government and the public to make a decision with every bit of public process, and then as you get closer and closer to the actual action, those decisions should be made. Now, that's just another side of what I'm saying. When I say I'm not changing a jot, tittle, or iota of the policy outcome, just trying to make it more efficient, that's my view. Others could view it differently, and I don't call it just paranoia. They might really, truly see it differently. Where's the process for getting those people to common ground? And as legislators and in your communities, boy, when you don't get to common ground, when you have people that just won't budge.
I think that we're getting to the end. If there's no more burning questions or statements that need to be made, I have a couple. Thank you, first and foremost, gentlemen, for what you're doing. I think that this committee particularly is going to get a pretty good flavor right off the bat in how complex government is, how hard it is to find intelligent ways to resolve some of the, you know, really important issues we're talking about here. And I hope, even if the room doesn't fill, that at the end of this, because I've asked for a lot of these bills, that we will feel like we have advanced, I think, our own personal agenda about making state government more responsive to the people that elected us. And so I hope to have a sort of a book of these kinds of bills. Any information that can be provided, you know, through my office on any of these issues, certainly ask and we'll get it done. I also appreciate that these aren't going to be perhaps the most exciting things. So thank you for your attention to this and your attention to these folks who are on the ground really working on some of the really difficult problems. And when we get this all done, this section, I can assure you, Mr. Gallagher, that this committee's good enough. We're going to tackle that interface between state government and local government. Sure we are. Okay.
You will fill the hearing room, Madam Chair.
Well, because we all understand that when we go out to the public, they don't know the difference.
Yes, that's true.
To them, a regulation's a regulation, and they don't know whether it's state. And the buck get passed even when there is none. We get blamed, and we blame. And the feds are in this, too.
I will tell you that if you read these reports carefully, you will see countless references to the land use process and the land use appeals process as being the
poster child
yeah. of where the frustration focuses.
Yep.
You get a liquor license or go through a sting operation, you get involved in OLCC. But almost every one of us at some point in time, both on the pro and the con, I'm not saying that there's a right or wrong here, but every one of us gets involved in that land use process.
Yes.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Any announcements?
Madam Chair, I just want to let you know that Representative Sumner and I are working on a bipartisan scandal for the committee to try to get more attention.
To get more interest in here, whatever, you know.
Yeah.
Check with me for approval before you bring it in. Anything else? Announcements, Karen?
No, thank you.
Then we will stand adjourned. We'll start hearing.